Thanks for downloading this podcast, which is for personal use only. All contents are copyright Radio Show Limited and must not be reproduced, rebroadcast, or used in any form without permission. For contact details, go to www.radiolemon.com.
Hello there, this is John Heindorf with another one of our long-form interviews, and today I've caught up with a gentleman who I first met probably about 6 months ago now at the Britcar 24, and through our shared love of all things automotive, got on with very well indeed. A very affable man who you will have heard us talking about. He is now the man at the head of Mission Motorsport, and he has other responsibilities beyond that. Many of you will have known, will know him from Twitter at Tankslider. He is James Cameron. You, of course, come from a military background, and you were what rank in the military?
I was a major in the Royal Tank Regiment for about 17 years.
And your Twitter, I love your Twitter description, which says rather handy in times of war.
Yeah, well, you don't like to blow your own trumpet, but I suppose I'm all right. I'm quite useful. So quite handy to have around in conditions like that. And the whole tank slider thing comes from an incident with a Challenger 1 on a frozen tank part in Paderborn in Germany when I was a second lieutenant, that left me doing punishment duties for about a month and a half afterwards.
Maybe we'll leave that till it passes the statute of limitations and the Official Secrets Act in 50 years' time. We'll be able to talk about that. Before we talk about what you're doing now and Mission Motorsport, one of the things we like to do on these interviews is get a sense of the person that we're talking to. And clearly, as a career military man, that's going to go back a bit further. But were you always interested in motorsport even before your time in the military?
Yeah, I mean, completely. I'm firmly of the belief, and there's that old sick quote, and I don't know who came out with it, but the first motor race, when was the first motor race? It was when the second car was built. I'm a firm believer of that. So I've always loved my cars. When I was at university, I mean, I first started off actually with Land Rovers doing trialing, because that was all I could afford. That was the only competitive form of motorsport I could do at university. Did that quite a lot and ended out weirdly driving a bit of support car for Toyota at the Kenya Safari Rally through some rather weird connections of mine and a friend who I had, which was pretty interesting. But then the military career took over, and that sort of set aside, well, it put heavy metal in place of some of the lighter ones.
So large, yeah. Diesel engines.
Yeah, but you know, V12 alloy wheels, twin turbo setups. You know, I was pretty happy.
And a big gun.
Yeah, the gun helps. I find that quite persuasive at times. I mean, we actually put a Challenger 2 on the inside of Cops at Silverstone for the Britcar 24 back in 2011, which I don't know if it intimidated anyone else, but it gave me something to look at anyway as I motored my way serenely past it.
Is the military in your family, James? Is that why you went into it? It's a career choice. We understand that, and particularly nowadays, it's a job to get people to sign up for the military. What attracted you to that originally?
Well, it's interesting. I think if you'd have talked to me as a young officer around the times I was donutting tanks in tank parks in Germany, I would have told you about, you know, 70-ton main battle tanks and you know, being in charge of three of them and how much they could fire and stuff. And if you'd have talked to me as a captain, you know, perhaps 10 years ago, I would have told you about the amount of budget I was running and, you know, the number of the size of operation that I was running. It's interesting sort of looking back. I mean, the big privilege I always had throughout was working with soldiers. And that really has been the absolute privilege of a military career. It's amazing, you know, to get let loose with... the kit's kind of cool and sexy and people like that and they get interested in that. But the real privilege, to be honest, is to be let loose with Her Majesty's soldiers.
Yeah.
Which is... Yeah, that really has been the highlight of my career. Blokes.
And was, as I say, was that in the family, or was that something that you were at university and it was attractive to you, or what?
Yeah, and I can't confess this on radio. I nearly joined the RAF, which my dad had done his national service with the RAF, but I got as far as doing private pilot's licence and stuff with the cadets. And I'm going to get incredibly ribbed for this, you realise.
Yeah.
But it was actually a mate of mine who was in the Army Cadets, took me off for a weekend with the Army Cadets, and that was it, really. A weekend at Catterick. And that sort of set me on that.
It can turn a young lad's head, frankly.
Yeah, it can freeze a brass monkey's.
Yeah.
But But that's what did it. So I went through university on an army scholarship and went straight to Sandhurst in 1995, and that was sort of my path ever since, really.
Now, obviously, you've progressed through the ranks, and from what you've said there, like many jobs, the higher you get up, the more, in some ways, divorced you get from the coalface, from the shot. And it sounds like you were taking on an administrative role as much as you were a warrior's role.
Yeah, I mean, I was commanding the armour group in Afghanistan in 2011, and when I came back from that...
He says casually, which would have been how many men and how much equipment?
It's about 31 armoured vehicles, plus a supporting fleet of sort of 20-odd, 160-odd tankies, and then because it's task-organised, things, you know, I'd get different things attached to us, so it sort of peaked at over 300 at times, so... quite a lot of blokes, a lot of responsibility. Professionally, the most fun I've ever had.
Yeah,
it has to be said. I mean, an extraordinary job, but commanding the independent squadron as well. You don't have a direct boss as a lieutenant colonel up above you. You're working directly to the brigadier, who's in charge of British forces in Helmand, and he's quite a busy bloke. So there's not too much. It does allow a certain amount of interpretation of will rather than direct instruction. So, yeah, good fun.
A question that our listeners are, I'm sure, barking at the radio right now, but it's dangerous. You get shot at. People under your command get killed, get injured. What, if anything, can prepare you for that and then take you through that?
It's really... It is difficult. And... I remember we were expecting fatalities on the tour. The armoured group isn't doing any of the other roles that guys are out there in Helmand doing. We're not mentoring a group of Afghans to take a similar role. So the armoured group is there really as a club. You're there to close with and kill the enemy, so to pick fights and win them. Mm-hmm. And it means that it's therefore quite a kinetic sort of task. You know, that you tend to go places where shooting is happening. And you go there in order to beat up bad guys. So the guys before us, and my regiment had done that tour. A squadron had done that tour some 2 years before. Very sadly, three guys were killed on that. So we kind of prepared ourselves for it. And it's an interesting sort of mental preparation process. But I do remember we were in South Wales doing some ranges about 3 weeks before we were due to go, and I got all of my senior ranks together because they're the real sort of heart of the squadron. Mm. You know, rather than the young officers, it's the seniors who really sort of corral the boys, and said and we went and had a night in the pub and said, you know, right, come on, what are we going to do when it happens? How are we going to deal with it?
Yeah.
To understand how morally we could sort of pull together and find our feet again as a group if you know, sort of the worst happened, and that, you know, so I think you prepare for it as best you can.
Yeah.
But
do you ever get used to being shot at?
Yeah, no, you do. Well, it's interesting. I mean, you know, because obviously...
I know it's part of your job. You do it so we don't have to. And I think that's one of the things that civilians perhaps have the most difficulty, yeah. That your job is to put yourself in harm's way, effectively.
Well, everybody sort of forgets. And they go, well, you know, thank God you're not getting shot at anymore. I always really enjoyed that bit. I mean, everybody forgets. That's the bit when you get to shoot back, which is really bloody good fun. But, I mean, to be honest, if you spend 6 months waking up every morning, incredibly well-funded, well-resourced, surrounded by your best friends and some of the finest professionals that you've ever had, you've been fortunate enough to work with, and you think to yourself, what are the things that most annoy me in my life? And then you come up with a plan at how you can surround, machine gun and kill them. It's kind of liberating, you know. You get to do that for 6 months. It's quite entertaining.
It's the way you say that in such a matter-of-fact way that I still think most of our listeners would find difficult. And I'm sitting next to you, and I find that remarkable. I still find that remarkable. You come to the end of your tenure in the armed forces.
Yeah.
And so what happens at that point? What was the plan for one James Cameron at that stage?
I think I was at an interesting point in my career. I'd done 16 years. I had 16 left to go until a pension at 55, which I know is a real privilege in this day and age.
Yeah.
But was looking at the barrel of a lot of staff jobs. And a couple of other things had sort of changed really for me and the family, which meant that I knew I was going to be needed at home a lot during 2011. And the army was probably going to be sending me back abroad again in some capacity. And so I needed to get some personal things right as well. Because I've got a bit of a motorsport background, you know, sort of club racing and stuff like that, and, you know, friends with Mazda and various other bits and pieces, writing for a few different magazines and media outlets has meant that I've got some good connections in motorsport. I've always used that in the past to raise money for service charities. 2011 changed the way that I saw that a little bit. Having good friends, for example, within the Lotus On Track Drivers Club, you know, they'd said, look, we'll give you an arrive and drive. We can auction it off or something when you come back. You know, that would be a good thing to do. Simultaneously, Help for Heroes, you know, this incredible fundraising machine, not very well publicised, but developed something called the Quick Reaction Fund, which was money that it gave to the Army Benevolent Fund and the Royal British Legion, two very traditional charities, but on whom the demands had gone up dramatically as a result of recent conflicts. And Help for Heroes just gave the money to them and said, you know, you are not accountable to us for how this money's spent. Just do it, doing the thing. Now, that puts me out there with a collection tin, you know, raising money for forces charities a bit into context. So I thought, right, perhaps some of my energies are best spent. And it was quite personal, really. I mean, in my squadron of sort of 160 guys, I had about 15% life-changing injuries, you know. So everybody's quickly doing the math, sort of 20-odd guys with significant injury. And a larger population of blokes who were affected. And I really wanted to do something for them. So,
And were you intent on coming out of the service at that time? Or did you feel you could do more from externally than you could internally?
No, at that time, very much, I was really sort of staying in.
That's quite a big decision, isn't it? When you've been part of something for 16, 17 years, the bulk of your adult life, and it's an all-encompassing lifestyle. It's not like a 9-to-5 job. It is a life, not just a job. And to make that decision, that must have been, regardless of what else was going on in your life at that time, that must have been a big decision for you.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, it was, and still is, really. I think it also gets driven by having a young family. I mean, I've got two kids, the youngest of whom arrived while I was in Afghanistan during the last tour. And the eldest of which is just, you know, starts to understand more about what dad's up to and where dad is or where dad isn't at home. And that, you know, that starts to shape the way you feel as well. And I think that helped make the decision, really, as much as anything else. But disappearing off to go and do other things is difficult. And I think it's hard enough leaving the armed forces. I mean, you see enough warrant officers at their 22-year point who have known for 22 years that that's the point at which they're going to get out. Finding it difficult to adjust on the other side.
Yes.
But for our guys who are leaving the forces through trauma or traumatic injury, not on their own terms, then I think that's incredibly difficult. And I firsthand was watching some of my guys really struggle with that transition. And that's sort of what motivated me to help.
So we're getting closer now to the start of what has become Mission Motorsport. Mm. It clearly didn't start, or you tell me, did it start as a perfectly formed idea and the words Mission, Motor and Sport on the top of a piece of paper and then some bullet points after it?
No, I mean, you'd be unsurprised to know Mission Motorsport was written on a beer mat. in a pub just outside Oxford somewhere. It was very straightforward. I mean, for example, I had the offer of a race drive that I could have auctioned off to raise money for funds. Instead of that, actually, the picture's behind you, John. There was a young man who was blown up in March of 2011, who's a Warthog driver, who was recovering well enough. But it's an absolute
sort of a small armoured vehicle, a Warthog.
Yeah,
isn't it?
It is. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, he was a really nice young lad, a complete petrolhead. He used to drive my Sergeant Major nuts by leaving tatty E30 BMWs in various states of disrepair, some with no wheels on, in the squadron car park. He was recovering well, but was really down in the dumps. And I wanted something to lift him, and I thought, Christ, if I can get him through his ARDS test, through his medical, then there's no reason why he shouldn't be able to go and race. So we, Lotus On Track Drivers Club, helped out. Mike Wiles came along, did a bit of tuition. And then he successfully raced at Donington in two rounds of the Elise Trophy and a round of the Lotus Cup. Supported by, you know, took a load of the boys along in order to go and support him, and they helped run the car. And there was one young man in particular, Will Madden, who had been blown up earlier on that year, 19-year-old lad. He'd only been in the army 6 months and come to us straight out of training. Trained up, went on operations, and was blown up tragically early in the tour. Still with no sensation down his right-hand side. And I was really shocked, actually. You know, having said I came back from operations in May, some of my guys had come back in December. And a lot of water had gone under the bridge since then. And they were away from us as well, which is difficult. I was shocked at just how far he'd sort of fallen and just how depressed he'd become. Really? This bright young man, you know, really engaged. And so we're like, come on, get yourselves out. Dragged him out of his house because he wasn't able to do his job in the army, so he'd effectively been sent home, and said, right, come racing. And he loved it. And he threw himself into it to the extent that the Lotus guys rang up about a month later and said, can we possibly take Will to Spain? And after I'd established it wasn't, you know, to take him to Ibiza to bum him, you know, he went out and did the Barcelona 24-hour race, right. and went a mechanic for them. Flew back from Barcelona. His mum washed his kit for him. He reported straight to Silverstone, where Jota then trained him up, and he was number one man on the right-hand front wheel for the Brit Car 24 entry.
No way.
I noticed you said reported to Silverstone. There's some habits right. that still die hard.
No, he worked for me. He was reporting.
At this point, we should say that clearly by now the idea of what has we know now as Mission Motorsport is becoming more formed. But we should say that one of the reasons that we have the guys coming back and coming through Mission Motorsport is because of the advances in medical technology and because more people survive nowadays, to be quite honest.
Yeah.
Injuries that a decade, 15, 20 years ago, they simply wouldn't have.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And it's the surgical procedures that, you know, tragically they're getting an awful lot of experience in is astounding. But it's also the front-end first aid that's given by buddy-buddy system, you know, soldiers to their mates. The incredible life-saving stuff that can go on the battlefield allows people to make it back intact. And funnily enough, it was around that time of the Brit Car 24-hour race that I met a guy called Gav Harvey, who was I'd watched on Top Gear, having a weepy moment under the bonnet of a Land Rover with Richard Hammond. And he'd been part of an organisation called Project Mobility that, I'd gone wrong for a number of reasons. But Gav was desperately keen to just try and go rallying, and that organisation had not managed to complete a single day's national stage rallying in 2 years of trying. You know, and it really just by not doing things properly, very frustrating to sort of see soldiers being attached to activity that was not being run professionally. And that really wound me up.
Well, that's the professional in you. It would be the professional in any of us, but particularly with an ordered background that you have and the ordered background that these guys are used to, that is actually possibly doing more harm than good, surely.
Yeah, literally, in some instances, you know, doing more harm than good. And it's a duty of care thing. It's really simple. There, you can't mess about with soldiers' lives. They don't deserve that. So if you do something, you've got to do it properly. If you're doing it with a soldier in recovery, in the eyes of the law, he's a vulnerable adult. So there's a whole bunch of things, but that duty of care thing really is the thing that flicks my switch. Yeah, I love the cars, you know, all the shiny things, it's all great. That's all good fun. I get to go to some cool places. That's great. But it's the duty of care thing that really drives me in order to ensure that we get that bit right.
But that's we're talking motorsport here. We could be talking, I don't know, pick anything, music, painting. We could be talking any other activity because that actually is the means to an end. The end being to get people to believe in themselves again, presumably. And it's as much about a mental state as it is a physical state.
Very much so. It's interesting. I mean, our website, largely, I think the content on it mainly comes from me, so I sort of have to produce that stuff. And I got beaten up at the tail end of last year to do a little bit of an update, and I'd produced a sort of one page, it's about 8 photographs, I think, which sort of summed up 2012 for me, the stuff we do with a couple of lines, easily digestible, only takes about a minute to read. And it sort of encompassed what we'd done during 2012. And the interesting thing was, it wasn't deliberate. Somebody commented a couple of weeks later and said, there aren't any cars in it. And there are when you look, but they're incidental.
Yes.
They're in the background.
Yes.
And what there actually are is pictures of people, because
yes.
that's what you're trying to do. And in fact, the cars are just the tool that we're using in order to unlock it, or motorbikes, or powerboats, or whatever else it is, you know, extra 300 aerobatic aircraft. I don't care. What you're trying to do is to find that thing which turns a bloke's lights back on
yeah.
and gets him to engage. Tail end of 2011, I was formally tasked by Defence to look at providing motorsport as a recovery activity, how it could best be done. We looked at a number of ways of doing it, and the Combined Services Disabled Ski Team, a very good organisation. There's a charity called Toe in the Water doing a similar thing with skiing.
Nice.
Looked at some examples of what we thought had been done well, and also some examples of what to avoid.
Yeah.
And Help for Heroes very kindly had said straight away we could do Racing for Heroes or Help for Heroes Racing, you know, something like that, and do it under their banner, which would have certainly been the fastest way to do it. But Help for Heroes does not have an all-encompassing remit, you know, which is why they work with others in order to get things done. And so with a heavy heart and a hell of a lot of hard work over that winter season, Mission Motorsport, the charity, was established as a registered service charity. Richard, who is my co-director, who's been helping run my racing, sort of grand phrase for the last few years, is a professional businessman, and therefore he does all the things which I'm absolutely rubbish at, you know, which, to be frank, is all the difficult stuff, much of the detail.
I'm with James Cameron of Mission Motorsport for one of our long interviews, and we're talking about the genesis, if you like, of the idea of Mission Motorsport and how it's come forward. I'm interested to hear there, James, that the go-ahead came from within the armed services, from the armed services committee, which is a part of the government, for those of you who are not familiar with how we're set up here in the UK. And that shows to me a real understanding, or at least a will to understand, that sometimes things that are slightly off the wall might be the right thing. Because ultimately, if you wrote down a proposal and took it to government and said, we want to go out and have a load of fun with motor cars,
yeah.
because that's what they would have read between the lines, that's actually quite a difficult thing to sell. But for them to come and understand that is actually pretty far thinking.
Yeah, absolutely. But to be honest, the evidence was there. You know, and was really tangible, really, really noticeable, the effect that was had. And Richard had a hell of a job to do in order to get us stood up as a charity in a very short period of time. His target was to get it done by the 1st of March, which was due to be our launch date. He needed a leap year to do it, but on the 28th of February, we were granted charitable status.
Everything worked for you.
Yeah, it just kind of fell into place. And we turned up at Thruxton, supported by Melindy and Callum at Goldtrack, who... And Thruxton...
That's for those who know it, is Callum and Melindy Lockie. Callum, former British GT champion, no stranger to these airwaves as well.
No, I mean, I've known them for a long time, and they were tremendously supportive. And so we had this launch event at Thruxton, where the whole of the residents of Tedworth House, the centre of the defence recovery capability now, a load of guys from treatment at Headley Court turned up, and veterans turned up in their tens from across the country and descended upon Thruxton for a track day where, fortunately, the weather smiled on us. And we were able to get an astonishing range of cars out. There were a few things that really sort of struck me on that day. One was the support of people and the track day customers who just looked firsthand and went, this is fantastic, you know, where can we help out?
Yeah.
Would someone like to come and hop in our car and get taken around and things? But there was a young man who was one of the Tedworth House residents who was categorised as unresponsive. So he'd retreated inside his own shell. He'd wake up in the morning, he'd join in on activities, wouldn't venture any information, wouldn't volunteer anything, and would go to bed at the end of the day, and they didn't get anything out of him. We strapped him into a Track Group Exige race car with a young driver in next to him who went out, and it's my understanding that it was clearly a track day, so they weren't racing, but had a couple of laps in close proximity to some other cars, should we say. And the car pulled back into the pit lane, they opened the door, and this lad vented a string of expletives, as every good squaddy should, 30-second, you know, flow of invective that didn't repeat itself, and had a grin from ear to ear. And the guys who'd brought him, these carers from Tedworth House, were just blown away because that was more emotion than he'd shown in 2.5 months, you know, previous to that.
Yes.
What really brought it home, though, was the next day. I got a telephone. I was sat at my desk and I had a telephone call. And there was just a woman on the other end of the line and she was weeping. And I'm, you know, it's some time since I've had those sort of telephone calls. As my promised my wife, you know, that sort of thing's long behind me. It turns out she was one of the girls who works at Tedworth House. And she'd given us a rung because she was beside herself. This lad had woken up the next day, come down for breakfast, and the first thing he'd asked was, when am I going to the racetrack again? Now, this from a man who was categorised as unresponsive, you know, following extremely traumatic injury and God knows what else he'd seen. Yes. But we'd found his tickle spot. Yep. You know, that bit on the dog that you manage to hit that just stops them in their tracks and they absolutely, you have their undivided love and attention. And it's finding the tickle spots on these blokes and then turning that into something positive.
Just before we develop that, because I think that's a very important point about turning it into something positive, because this is not in capital NOT about having a bit of fun and then cutting people loose after doing 2 or 3 laps in a sexy car. One of the things that you mentioned there, which I think is quite interesting, is you almost sounded quite surprised that civilians, members of the general public, would be as interested and as helpful as they clearly have been in the early stages and going forward in this. Is that again because of the military style of thing where you're almost sort of living almost like in a bubble?
Yeah, it's really interesting, and particularly now as we're developing that vocational side, as you're talking about what these guys are going to do next.
Yes.
Explaining that a guy who lacks formal qualifications on a CV that are recognisable instead actually has a bunch of other qualities which he just takes for granted, that those aren't shared with the rest of the civilian population, that he's presentable, that he's well turned out, that he's relatively easy to talk to, that he has an innate and fundamental understanding of teamwork, just does it automatically without any contrived action,
and discipline and self-discipline
completely. Mm. And is hygienic and is, you know, occasionally. And will not stand by and watch somebody else struggling to do a given task because it isn't within their job description, that doesn't down tools at 4:58 in order to walk out of the door at 5 on the dot, has no real understanding of timekeeping, to be perfectly honest. Those are the things that the military guys just sort of take for granted, and they assume that the outside world is like that. Now, you actually don't have to take too long to explain that to an employer, because most employers have come across it in some way, and they understand it, and they realise that that's what they get when they get a military guy. The people who, funnily enough, don't understand that the most are the blokes. And they don't realise...
Because they don't see it.
No. And they don't realise just how well they are perceived by the outside world.
Yeah.
And it was one of the real beauties of getting these guys out, like young Will Madden, you know, putting him alongside Joe to the race team. You know, you say to them, you know, what can you do? I mean, Gary Dunning, classic example of that. He came on that launch day. He didn't have confidence to talk to us, a pioneer of some 20 years service, about to be medically discharged. I mean, this guy he was in charge of the party that retrieved bodies from the battlefield in 2003 when we went into Iraq. And that left him with severe PTSD. And he'd been through the mill completely, absolutely hit rock bottom. And, you know, and has spoken about it since very eloquently, but at that time, and we're only talking about March last year, didn't have the confidence to come and talk to us about it. So went home at the end of the day, but was showing his wife, this is what I did yesterday. And she, funnily enough, recognised me. She's a MOD civil servant. And said, I know that bloke. And she came and found me the next day and she said, my husband came along. Can you please take him and go and do more stuff? So we took Gary, and he was a bloody good driver. And he took instruction really well as well. Because there's... The blokes take instruction really well. And you've got lads like, you know, Matt Bell, Joe Osborne, going, it's a real pleasure to teach your blokes. I'd love to come back and do it again. And you're like, well, why? And so, well, they do what you tell them.
Yeah.
Because there's no...
Again, that's hardwired, isn't it? And they take that for granted. Yeah. But having done a bit of driving instructing myself, sometimes you'd rather start with somebody who has zero idea about what they're doing, because you're working with a blank canvas, than someone... Because there's only two things that you can't tell, particularly blokes, about, is driving...
And having sex.
And, well, I was going to say, and dealing with women, yes. You're more direct than me. And yet, from the military standpoint, of course, it's, I can make you do your job better if you do it this way. It's a no-brainer, effectively, isn't it?
They come from a background where if you don't do what you're told, people die. So they're really good at taking direction, but they also do it without humility, and that's the thing that you're alluding to. Yes. You know, you can't tell men to do things because, you know, it's the Eddie Irvine syndrome of how hard can it be? I can drive, you know. If that knobber can do it, then I could too. They don't have any of that because they don't come from that sort of, you know, motorsport background. Mm. So if you've got a young lad, doesn't matter if he's a young lad, you know, Joe, Matt, Ewan Hankey, you know, has done some instruction for us. Andrew Bentley has been brilliant. You know, he's popped up throughout, actually, is Andrew, on various stages of the way. They've really enjoyed teaching the guys because they just soak up the information. And generally speaking, you don't need to tell them to do things twice.
I think part of that as well is down to the fact that, quite clearly, and having spoken to some of the guys that you're talking about, they recognise very quickly someone who has the knowledge and who can impart the knowledge and give them the respect. Age is not a part of this.
No.
It's about, can this person help me? And that, I mean, you've just said it there and I sort of giggled in the background, or, you know, but they're used to having to do that, otherwise people die. And it doesn't matter whether you're 40 and the guy who's telling you something is 26, because at that point it doesn't matter, does it?
No, not at all. And they're probably used to young officers, you know, like myself when I came out of Sandhurst. It was a complete clown, you know. They did, well, they followed me out of curiosity, if nothing else. So,
I'm sure that's not the case.
I can assure you it was.
There was a look of just distant past that came over James's face there. What strikes me about this whole journey that you're taking us on here is the common sense attitude that you and everybody else has taken to it, because it's almost like, oh yeah, that makes perfect sense as you explain it. And it's almost like, how has that light not gone on before in some respects?
Yeah, no, I must admit, I do sort of keep coming across that. And you just think, why has this not been done before? And in places it has.
Yeah. Yeah.
People that have had goes at it. We're not the first people to go, you know, wouldn't it be great if we could show a guy a good time by taking him out? It's really interesting, actually. My last boss in the army is a guy called Stephen Seagrave. And he's the head of the Seagrave family, and he's the direct descendant of Sir Henry Seagrave. Who, if you read his biography, Henry Seagrave was a 20-minuter flew Sopwith in the First World War. Was wounded and sent back to for convalescence back to the UK, where he went to the soldiers' homes with his race car and dragged them out for the afternoon in order to scare the living daylights out of them. And I didn't discover that, actually, for some time. But what I did notice, you know, and this is sort of through 2011, is, I mean, I was doing all of this at the same time as doing a staff job, and quite a crunchy one as well.
Quite a crunchy one. Explain that military terminology to me.
Yeah, sorry, that was a horrible bit of military terms. It was just quite a busy job, really, with a fair bit of responsibility, and we're spending a fair amount of time, you know, disappearing off at racetracks or spending time on the phone, you know, discussing the recovery of individual soldiers. Stephen Seagrave was really understanding of that, and I didn't realise why until he gave me a copy of the autobiography and read that. It was like round about chapter two, I suddenly went, I understand where this is coming from. And it was we've just set about doing, I don't think there's anything we're doing is rocket surgery. That's another nice phrase. It's a mixture of two.
Rocket surgery.
Nothing's rocket surgery. It's but we're just making very certain that we're doing it properly. So we handled no money whatsoever until we had charitable status, so that we were completely auditable and transparent in how funds were handled. That we don't do anything with any of the guys who are serving without medical risk assessment for what they do. Mm-hmm. And that all of our formal activities are conducted on duty. So that means if a guy, you know, perish the thought, has some sort of an incident at the circuit or even a car accident on the way there, he's covered by the Armed Forces Compensation Scheme because he's doing something which is on duty and part of his service. It's agreed by the chain of command and it's official activity. And frankly, if you do things which are in recovery for soldiers outside that, then you're not meeting that duty of care thing and you're not getting those basics right. And that's a fundamental for us.
Over the last, 18 months, as you're describing, clearly things have come on a pace. And we've had There's a wry smile and a rubbing of the nose and forehead from my interviewee here. I think I may be slightly understating that. You've had some real great successes. Obviously, I met you originally at the Brit Car, the back end of last year at the 24 Hours at Silverstone, and that was a great success. You've since gone on, with no detriment at all to Brit Car, to, in terms of PR and the logistical side of things, an even bigger project with the Dakar, which has garnered a lot of press and publicity, which is great. And clearly, for those guys who took part in all of that, as an individual, in that timescale, that's great as well. But the whole point of what you're doing and aiming for is that it doesn't stop there. That there's something beyond that. And that is a key part, and possibly even a key difference from things that have happened in the past. These are not taster sessions.
Yeah.
These are, if you like, preparing people or proving that people can do a job and do a job correctly.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, the motorsport is cathartic. There is value in a day away from your problems where you sort of put everything behind you. You go, you do something exciting and different. You strap yourself into a roller coaster or a Caterham or whatever it might be, and you forget about your problems for 5 minutes. You know, that has value. But particularly where you're capturing people's attention, you need to be using that in some sort of a positive way. And we accidentally found ourselves, you know, in that area with the likes of Will Madden, you know, being looked at incredibly well. And I was stood it with, I'd just got out of the car during the Brit Car 24 in 2011, and was stood next to Sam Hignett in the garage. And I think I'd done a particularly long stint. It was just sort of winding down from that. And I was talking to Sam and said, you know, what do you think of the boys? And he said, I think they're fantastic. You know, they're really good. But where are they? And we looked round and there's no sign. There are no blokes in the garage at all. Oh, I don't know where they are. So I looked at Richard, who's on the pit wall. He's frantically signalling and pointing next door. And we stuck our heads around next door. And the boys had all gone round there where there was a crash car that had come in. And they had this thing up on the side, and were trying to help the team to take the hot exhaust off the bottom of it in order to get this car back out on the circuit again. And they'd just gone next door and just started mucking in.
This was not a Jota team car. This was effectively a competitor, let's be honest.
You know. And it was somebody in the same class as us as well, you know. And the boys were all there busy desperately trying to get this car back out again. And they were, you know, dealing with the hot exhaust on the bottom of the car. And Sam stood there and looked at me and said, look, I get any number of applications from guys with a degree in motorsport from the University of God knows where. But at 4 a.m, when the chips are down, you know, and a crash car's in the garage, I don't want electron health and safety. I want that.
Yeah.
And pointed exactly at the boys.
In some ways, then, it sounds to me, as we develop this conversation, that there's actually more parallels between motorsport and service life than actually perhaps any of us realised when we first got involved in this.
It was really interesting, because, I mean, we're sat here on Heroes Classic Rally Stand, because We've had guys out doing classic rallying during the course of the year. We'll be out again next year doing Land's End, John and Groats, talking about how we can probably help some of their event running, because let's face it, it's just a logistics event that's involved in getting a bunch of cars from point A to point B. And it was interesting, Patrick, you know, who's talking about it, saying, yeah, no, but it's very late at night, difficult work, you know, in the dark, poor conditions, in the rain. And he stood talking to a guy he doesn't know, who's only got one leg. The other leg is about to be amputated in 2 months' time. He's talking to a young guy called Will Riggs. Will's just looking at him going, if no one's shooting at me, I'm not really that bothered. You haven't described anything difficult. There are no landmines or IEDs on the Land's End John O'Groats tour.
Yeah,
therefore, you know, I don't think...
What's the worst that can happen?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So, and I think we saw that when later on that year, you know, we were... After that first Brit Car 24 appearance, we then ended up running a car in Wales Rally GB, and took my sort of team of tankies and suddenly met them with this larger group of guys from across the services who'd been doing the rallying thing.
Yeah.
And picked them up and said, look, okay, so you haven't managed 3 consecutive stages of stage rallying before, but let's have a crack at Wales Rally GB, where we did really well. Won the class and did fantastically. And you know, there was a big
despite the best efforts of the driver, by the way.
Yeah, no, he wasn't very good. Very, very good navigator though, and a very good service crew. But there was a big jock who I met for the first time, who was out there, who, when the lads came together for the first time, they were changing the suspension on one of the cars. Went off and was having a quiet moment with himself in the corner, and I left him to it for a bit, and then wandered across and said, "You're right, you know, what's up?" And he was a gruff guy from Glasgow, but was really, really moved because Will Madden, who's the young man I was talking about, you know, done these things and gone on this thing, a 19-year-old. This jock was the lad who'd put him into the helicopter in the green zone in Helmand. Right. He was part of the infantry battalion who was there. And I'd always thought that Will had died, because somebody did die during that engagement. But you never know who it is, so that, you know, the wrong information doesn't get back to the families. These two met underneath a tatty rally car that we were running in a freezing cold service area of a car park, you know, in somewhere in the middle of Wales. And it's just tremendously cathartic, because the lads will talk to each other about stuff which they will never share with their loved ones, or with a therapist, or with a doctor, or with their chain of command. But a lot of it comes out, you know, when you have that collective endeavour of people coming together in order to achieve an aim. It's something that, I mean, you see, if you look at our website, teamwork is a theme that's really used a lot, because that's fantastic therapy in itself, in bringing out all sorts of bits and pieces. And helping people to deal with what's happened to them.
As I said, you've followed up all of those things with massively successful PR campaigns. Top Gear, you mentioned. We saw a lot about the build-up to Dakar on that. And that's great, because it gets it front and centre in the public consciousness. But it's almost... You know, that does a job, clearly, but it's the back end, isn't it, that's important? For example, you guys have done all that work with Land Rover, and, you know, Land Rover, Jaguar, big group. Yep. Wouldn't it be great to think that those guys might then look at some of your guys to give them jobs, apprenticeships, whatever, in the future? And indeed, parts of motorsport have opened up to you, and particularly Aston Martin recently have made a tremendous commitment. And I'm sure they'll tell me that they're not doing this for fun, they're doing this because the guys can do the job.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I can't take any of the credit whatsoever for the race to recovery piece. You know, the team that was pulled together to do that, set out to achieve an Everest of motorsport, you know, to go and do it. They've done it for fundraising reasons and in order to, you know, do something inspirational. And I think they've achieved that hand over fist. It's fantastic. And we look to sort of build on the success of that. But for those individual team members, I mean, Andrew Taylor, the team manager, ex-warrant officer who's done nothing else but, believe me, pull together that race to recovery effort for the last 18 months, was medically discharged in earlier this month, so some 2 weeks
ago. So he's now unemployed.
And, you know, we need to be finding out, right, what are we doing next with those guys? We're actually at Jaguar Land Rover talking to them about an initiative called the Recovery Career Service, which is an MOD-led, charity-funded initiative, which is formally providing vocational support to servicemen post-injury for the wounded, for the injured, and for the sick. So for those who leave through medical reasons. We are delighted to be a part of that endeavour. I mean, Bentley, for example, have been partners to us from the very beginning. We've got lads there, two guys who were there a couple of weeks ago doing... interviewing for placements there to do some really exciting work with Bentley, and of course I think we're going to see them popping up doing a spot of racing in the next
could possibly see
you never know, which is really exciting.
I could be slightly un-PC and say they need a couple of tankies to help run the car because it weighs 2 tons too heavy than it should do. John Wickham will kill me for that, sorry John.
I mean the figures on that car are just extraordinary, aren't they? I mean, you know, if you, the standard Continental door, 86 kilograms, the door on one of those things, was it 5.5, 7 kilograms, something like that, something crazy. But I think that's really exciting. Jaguar Land Rover properly looking to engage on the back of the race to recovery thing. Clearly, there's a part of British industry that's made 2,800 jobs in the last 18 months alone. Mm-hmm. You know, of course, Nissan, you know, the astonishing work that's being done in Sunderland, you know, which is almost unheard about by the rest of the country.
Last year, it was the most productive single-site car factory
in the history of the United Kingdom. In the history of the, and 80-odd% of them went for export as well. And that's, I mean, Sunderland's my hometown, and I was part of the team that took Nissan to Washington in the first, or Sunderland in the first place, when I was with the Development Corporation in a whole different life ago. But that, to me, even when I saw that stat, I had to go and check it. But that, you know, there's a real buoyancy in the British automotive industry at the moment, and the automotive industry based in the UK, I should say. And it's great that they're getting behind you. And not, you know, clearly brands like Nissan, brands like Jaguar Land Rover and Aston Martin are understanding of what you're trying to achieve.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's a huge success story. Mm. But of course, with that success comes growth. You're seeing Bentley, you know, announcing astonishing growth sort of year on year as they're meeting the demand. Jaguar likewise with some, you know, a fantastic lineup these days. The extraordinary contribution to UK net export that is Nissan. I mean, over 10% of UK's exports is the car industry, is the motor industry, which is phenomenal. But then it's all the satellite things that feed that as well.
Yeah.
Need quality people.
Yeah.
And we have quality in abundance. And I think sort of industry recognise that. So we're seeing, you know, Motorsport Industry Association support now as we're starting to come online with them, really, to better get our message across that, you know, there is this resource which is out there. I'm not saying it's the golden bullet that's going to find 2,800 people for Jaguar, but we have some serious quality people who are now looking for that next step and what they're doing next in life.
If I can be slightly cheeky and ask a question, is... or has it been more difficult to get potential employers to look past the disability or the injury or the fact that people are coming from a background, a non-motorsport background and a military background instead?
I must admit, I've come across very few obstacles that have been thrown up through disability. I think, you know, it's interesting, I think the Paralympics this year really saw, you know, this last year, have seen a change in perception.
Yeah.
Because we just looked at that as Olympics too. That was brilliant, you know.
At one stage, I just thought, oh, we're clearly having Olympics every fortnight now, and that's going to carry on.
Yeah, no, in October, we were all on some sort of Olympic comedown, it was dreadful not having that to plug into anymore. And I think that's really changed the perception of the way things do. We're getting guys into all sorts of interesting corners, and I'm seeing people being genuinely innovative in the way in which they're being employed. So, I'll give you a couple of interesting examples. You've got Haymarket, the global media company, who have had one of our guys there doing viral YouTube videos for them, and also output for What Car and Auto Car, because his interest was sparked in us running. The powerboats last year, we ran a powerboat in P1 offshore, and he really loved the whole GoPro video camera stuff. We got him on an editing course, and lo and behold, you know, he's now off finding place in industry. And then you've got Maxted, Page and Prill, who've taken over the Motul account in the UK, doing some really exciting things with Andy and Lee over the course of the next year. We'll be out helping them run 8 cars in Tour Auto, is fairly astonishing. But if you order Motul oils, not only do, you know, they've revolutionised the way in which that's distributed, it's all a lot of the stock now held forward in the UK. The bloke who is that link in between order and stock going out the door is a single amputee called Lionel O'Connor, who Andy is personally mentoring in order to get this young man who was wounded all the way back in 2006, who frankly has languished in the recovery system for 6 years. You know, by God, he's got a fire underneath him now, you know, and Andy Prill breathing down his neck. And that's astonishing, exactly what he needs.
We see you mostly wearing your Mission Motorsport hat. I was going to say, you've got the jacket on at the moment. But you actually have another title, which is, I think, is it liaison to the automotive industry?
Yeah, no, well, it's not me. I've worked quite hard to make it the organisation. So Mission Motorsport are the relationship managers to the motor industry.
There you go. Right.
For all vocational activity for the wounded, injured and sick. So we're now fulfilling a function for the Ministry of Defence And for the Recovery Career Service, this new initiative, it'll be fully online 2nd of April, or at least politically online on the 2nd of April, as we get things up and running.
How important is that to come through a single point then, rather than being a disparate set? And again, I'm not being disparaging at all, but so many times these things get diluted by not being focused to a sharpened point.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And MODs, for right or for wrong, it's very interesting when we've been talking a lot with our friends over in the US recently. There's much less difference in funding availability for a guy who's wounded in the US or the point he's serving to the point he becomes a veteran. It's still a lot of government-funded initiatives. And that's not the case in the UK. You know, there's a lot of government stuff, but at the point when he is discharged, then it's the third sector, he's into the hands of the charities in order to help pick that up. And right or wrong, that's the way we do things in the UK. What we're seeing now is much more maturity in the way that charities are coming together, and the MOD is working in partnership with charities in order to deliver a given effect. So previously, jobs for veterans went through an organisation called the Defence Employment Opportunities Team, which was half a lieutenant colonel, one full-time major, and two clerks in Andover. They were looking after the affairs of thousands of veterans, thousands of serving guys as well, you know, over 1,000 serving guys as well, who were in need of support into their next, I mean, whatever it would be next. And the Help for Heroes is, you know, quote, was of the FTSE top 100 companies, 42 had a standing offer to do something in support, whether it's direct jobs, placements, assessment, vocational training, whatever. That's not going to be done by half a lieutenant colonel, one major, you know, and a bunch of guys. What we're now seeing is an organisation's coming together with the Army Benevolent Fund, Help for Heroes, Walking with the Wounded, and the Reserve, the Regular Forces Employment Association, and a wee slice of Mission Motorsport in there as well, in order to deliver a focus package that's looked on helping individuals.
I'm conscious of how much of your time you've taken up. I want to explore one thing relatively quickly, and you mentioned the American connection. And there's becoming a more of a connection with our allies over on the other side of the puddle. You've been involved in that as well. That is very exciting in so many different ways, because there's clearly a bilateral amount of learning that's going on, because they're clearly doing some things much better, particularly with funding. Maybe they're learning from some of the initiatives that you've been putting forward.
Well, it was very interesting. We sort of went across a couple of months ago in order to go and have a chat with some people. They do things differently. Some of the stuff which we're doing, they see as very exciting and pioneering. You know, you go across and brief them about this fantastic joined up British system, because, you know, this has existed for what, you know, 10 months. and it's evolving all of the time. But there is a simple truth to, you know, we fight on operations alongside the Americans. You know, we should be alongside them in recovery as well. There is a veterans initiative now, which is a top level, was set in place by the president and the prime minister, which has a number of initiatives. One of them is medical, looking at the sort of issues that you were talking about, the fantastic advances in medical technology. A lot of work goes into post-traumatic stress disorder. There's one on recovery sports, which clearly we have a big slice of, and the other is vocational element, and we're great interest in the last two, and we are looking to join some of that up. We will run an exchange, the first of a lot of activity with the US this summer, where we'll have a number of wounded US servicemen who will come across to the UK to come alongside some Mission Motorsport activity. To come and meet some of our friends, particularly we mentioned Aston Martin briefly earlier. Yeah. In their centenary year, we're doing an awful lot with them, which is fantastic. Hands-on stuff for the guys, you know. And they're very much, you know, Aston Martin Racing doing some incredibly exciting things this year, just watching the build of this amazing brand, you know, in celebrating their centenary year. So we'll have guys amongst that. So these blokes are going to come across from America, are going to get dropped off Brands Hatch with all of the history that goes with it for the 100-year anniversary of Aston Martin. They'll do a bit of Formula One factory. They're going to be stood on the bowl at Brooklands. We're actually making a drift car, a V12 CL600 drift car.
Of course you can.
As you do. With Brooklands College, where we have a young man who's a double amputee who's going to be driving it. It's on hand controls. There's a nice bit of history, clearly, with Brooklands, which, you know, I think the Americans will find quite interesting.
Yeah.
And then their week will finish at the Goodwood Festival of Speed.
You know, they're going to go back with minds completely blown. It's as simple as that. Finally, for you, as well as for the project, clearly the work has only just begun. But if I was to sit down with you in, I don't know, let's say 3 years' time, not the ubiquitous five, where would you like to be with this? And what would you as an individual and Mission Motorsport as an organisation, what would you like to be able to say to me, right, John, this is what we've achieved?
The thing I'd like to point out, I think, is numbers of blokes happily in jobs. Or numbers, and jobs isn't necessarily the right answer. It's vocation almost. Because job isn't the answer for some people.
No.
You know, but it's vocation too.
Well, there's no off-the-peg solution for everybody, is there? Individuals are, spookily, individuals.
No, and for example, you know, we've had the Silverstone Marshals have been fantastic at coming alongside in order to help. But that rings bells with a lot of blokes as well who may not be interested in a career and things afterwards, but do like that, coming together as a team. They've got some bloody good paramedic training. But in order to, you know, deliver a sporting effect, they're motorsport fans and that can be good for them too. I'm confident that that's exactly the way in which we're going. The sparkly sort of top things that people get excited about, like the big 24-hour races, you know, and the sort of big places, I think we will continue to progress with those. And we've got our eyes on a couple of things that I think are achievable. So they'll continue to get more exciting. But the important thing about those is, you know, for the guy that you see on the podium, there is a pyramid of people underneath them.
Absolutely.
Who have benefited and have been brought on as part of that activity.
You're talking to a motorsport savvy audience right now. So this will be ringing a bell with a lot of them. A lot of what you do is the hard work that you do is about contact. So if people want to get in contact with you, if they feel they can help in some way or they can put you in touch with someone else, that clearly is part of what you need to do and to pull together. How do they do that?
It's really easy, through our website. I can generally be found on Twitter when I'm not supposed to be.
I can vouch for that.
At Tankslider. But through the website, there's a number of ways to get in touch. And, of course, the Facebook as well is just full of great stuff as it goes along. You know, that's now run sort of for us by Sue, the charity coordinator, who is just laden with stuff as we're doing things in different directions. So, yeah, just get in touch. Come and have a chat with us. Our calendar is now online as well, so people can get an idea of where we are and what we're doing, because a lot of the headline events make their way onto there. And that's not just for beneficiaries. That's for people who want to become involved too, whether it's supporters, whether it's volunteers, whether it's helpers, whether it's you know, potential sponsors and people who, you know, would like to come along and come and help out in a material way, or just simply to come and lend a hand. Loads of our presence is online, so no, I just encourage people to do that. And you can always drop me a line myself. I'm always available and not terribly far away from the more interesting things, really.
So that's missionmotorsport.com, is it, or .co.uk?
Well, actually, either will get you there.
Okay.
But missionmotorsport.org,
okay,
is where the main website is hosted. And if you drop us a line at team@missionmotorsport.org, it will come through to all of the management team. We'll see it and pick stuff straight up.
Thank you for your time. I hope you realise what a debt the rest of us owe the guys that you're helping and the guys who are still doing the jobs out there, and hopefully this will help get a little bit more of your message out to like-minded motorsport enthusiasts who would possibly like to say thank you to you as well. James Cameron, thanks very much indeed.
John, much appreciated, mate. Thank you.
This programme is a Radio Show Limited production. For more, go to www.radiolemon.com. Radio Show Limited. We talk to the world.